Good morning, Zbigniew Zelinski here, standing in for Marian Richardson. This was the Week of the Roses. Oh yes, it's that time of the year again. For the 54th time, we looked for the Rose of Tralee. And while it's all about the roses, the dancing and singing and cheering and the escorts, one thing this year seemed more important than anything else.
So if Kyle is here, your boyfriend, we're going to get him in here as well. So Kyle, are you there? So give a round of applause for Kyle, please. I'm going to go off and get your suit for you.
Man,
oh my, no,
please don't. I want to spend the rest of my life with you. Will you marry me?
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Congratulations, Molly. Well done.
Thanks, man.
Come here a second, Molly, hang on.
No.
Did you say yes?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
That's Molly Molloy Campbell as her boyfriend Kyle proposed to her in front of the whole world. The enduring nostalgic appeal of the Rose of Tralee intrigued writer Ro McDermott. She spoke to Evelyn O'Rourke on Arena.
It's a feeling that Christmas dinners are built on, that the gathering is counting on. And what the Rose of Tralee, that vaguely ridiculous time-travelling parade of lovely girls and lovely mothers, of strapless frocks and strapping escorts, delivers in spades. It has all the modernity, progressive politics and street cred of your ageing rural grandmother and all the welcoming warmth of her hearth. And it's for her. It's to tell her we haven't forgotten. Those girls who've returned to twirl out of dresses to do a jig, or read a poem dripping with embarrassingly earnest ill-formed rhymes, or croon their way through a trad ballad with all the grace of a wobbling saw. The girls who have returned from their new terrains of San Francisco or Sydney or Paris or Madrid to say that they remember. They remember it not mattering whether you're watching it to mock or watching it to dream, that you're always watching with someone. As the Dubliner muses, there's 10 good reasons to go and 10,000 tiny ones not to. And I don't know which is which anymore. Maybe these roses, these girls, this faintly absurd parade is both. It's a reminder of who we used to be, for better or for worse. It's old-fashioned, but then, what is memory if not fashioned of old? It's a crumbling landmark, but one people come back for. It's embarrassing, yet affectionate. Stuck in time, but there for you every single year. It's the family reunion. It's Christmas dinner. It's home.
Hayley O'Sullivan from Texas was crowned the Rose of Tralee 2013. She reflected on her win on Morning Ireland.
The competition changes every year as the women change, and I just think it speaks to the individuals that actually do enter. It changes every year. I think women are becoming more independent, and we can stand up and share our voices, so this is the greatest opportunity to do so.
The most impressive young woman of all this week, however, was 16-year-old Malala Yousafzai. The Pakistani girl, who survived being shot in the head and neck by the Taliban, received the Tipperary International Peace Award.
People know me as the girl who was shot by the Taliban. But I don't want to be the girl who was shot by the Taliban. I want to be the girl who fought for the rights of every child, whether girl or boy, their right of education and their right of equality. Some of us think that they can achieve anything with a gun. They can achieve anything with war. But I believe that education is the only way to peace. And education is my goal. Education is our goal. I want every girl and every boy to be educated. I want them to go to school. Peace is a situation where a girl is free to go to school, where every person has given the basic rights, the equal rights, where there is justice for everyone, whether he is poor or rich, whether he is tall or short, whether he is a Muslim or a Jew, whether he is a man or a woman. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to peace, but one day we will achieve. Long live Pakistan, long live Ireland.
And you can watch her speech in its entirety on rte.ie/news. Four Irish citizens sought refuge in Al-Fatah Mosque in Cairo last weekend after the violent clashes between the Egyptian security forces and the supporters of the deposed President Mohamed Morsi. Ibrahim, Fatima, Umayma and Sumaya Halawa are the children of the imam at the Islamic Cultural Centre of Ireland in Clonskee in Dublin. Anya Lawler managed to speak to Umayma last Saturday morning.
We are surrounded in Al-Fatah Mosque by the thugs around us. There are also the security forces are in front of the thugs, basically protecting the thugs going against us. There was a group of ladies who left. They were told that it was safe for them to leave, but as they left, they were attacked and taken. We are not safe to leave. I do not trust the security forces. I do not trust them coordinating with the thugs, and I'm not ready to leave, no.
What are conditions like there?
They're very critical condition. There are injured people here. The medical, there's not enough medical to take care of all of them. There are kids who are hungry. We haven't had anything to eat since yesterday. There's no food. The water is very rare and it's very critical condition.
How did you all end up there, Umayma?
We were in a peaceful demonstration and suddenly there was live bullets shot at us. So we ended up coming to the mosque. And then security forces as well as the thugs started pushing forward. Until they came in front of the mosque and people were surrounded inside the mosque.
And who are the people you call thugs that are being protected by the police and threatening your safe exit?
I can't explain thugs, they're just thugs. They have personally threatened me. They have personally looked me in the eye and threatened me to slaughter me when they see me.
They've said they'll slaughter you when they see you?
Yes, they've looked at me in the eye from the window and they will say, when you go out, I will slaughter you personally.
The siblings were detained at the security forces headquarters in the Tora district of Cairo after the siege of the mosque. Their sister Nosaiba is in Dublin and she spoke to Miles Dungan on Wednesday.
Can I ask you, your siblings, why did they go to Egypt? Why were they in Egypt in the first place?
In the first place, they went before everything started, before that all started. They went before the coup happened. Okay, they went for a regular summer holiday. And when the coup happened and everything started, they started to, because two of them is a digital media, they started to went and trying to record and trying to show the people what's happening in there. They tried to show the people that this is a protest that no one holding a gun or anything in it. It's just a peaceful protest.
So their sympathies lie with the Muslim Brotherhood, would that be correct?
No. They simply, and you can see it everywhere, they wanted democracy and freedom. It's not with the Brotherhood or no Brotherhood, it's democracy and freedom.
But their sympathies would lie with Mohamed Morsi, would they?
It's with the democracy, and democracy is with Mohamed Morsi. It's not because he's the Brotherhood. It's because he's the president. He presents the democracy now. So anyone who was in his situation, they will support him because he's presenting the democracy and the freedom.
Shima Awad is a freelance journalist critical of the current military regime. She was at the mosque with the Halawa siblings. She described to Jonathan Clinch what happened when the security forces stormed the mosque.
They opened the door by explosion, by smoke bomb, to frighten us. We were screaming. We are here without guns, without anything. We are just in Al-Fatah Mosque to pray, to get protected from shouting outside.
What was the mood of the Halawa siblings you were detained with? The men and the women were detained separately. What was their mood and your mood in the detention centre?
All of us were frightened, praying for Allah to go out. The room was very, very dirty, quite small. We were 33 person in a small room, I think 2 meters. So we were very, very frightened.
The arrest and possible charges of the Halawas sparked concerns over their welfare. Our European editor, Tony Connolly, spoke to Antonista Eamon Gilmore at the EU summit in Brussels on Wednesday.
We've been providing consular assistance to the four Halawa family members. There was a visit from a consular official from our embassy in Egypt yesterday. They're in good spirits, but we don't have any information at this point about any charges that may be brought against them.
But are you concerned about those reports?
Of course we're concerned, because our interest here is the welfare of the four Irish citizens who have been arrested. We are going to keep in contact with them. We're going to maintain consular contact with them and with their family, and we're going to watch the situation very closely.
While the Halawas await their fate in Egypt, Michaela McCollum Connolly from Tyrone and Melissa Reid from Scotland await theirs in Peru. They are in prison there for alleged drug smuggling. Lillian Allen is a 48-year-old Irish woman who is currently serving an 8-year sentence in Peru for similar offences. She spoke to Will Grant of the BBC.
And just as I was boarding, they stopped me. They said, tourist? I said, yeah. He says, you have drugs? I says, no. He says, can you come with me? I says, yeah. I went with him. They brought my 2 suitcases. They take the bag out and they cut the bag. They put like a cotton bud in the bag, and they came out and they said, coca. I said, no. And they took me to the police station after 12 hours. They cut the bags open and the cocaine fell on the floor. I've been here 25 months. I have never proved I'm innocent. I can't. You have to say you're guilty to get a shorter sentence. I always said I never wanted another girl to come in from my country. And she's young, she's only a little girl. She could be my daughter. She's younger than my sons. I will help her.
Brian O'Connell of the Today programme spoke to Terry Donaldson, who served 3 years in Barbados for drug smuggling.
It was a learning opportunity, let me put it that way. I had a chance to get off the stuff, get my thinking back. I read novels and things like that, anything really, bits of Bible as well, of course, just to pass the time and to keep the mind active. Jail I was in was called Glendary, and you'll see that if you Google it, but it was built about 1830. It was a slave pen before it became a prison. In prison, and I've since applied this to outside prison, my rule is stay away from the drugs and stay away from what we call the buller men. That's like the sexual deviants and so on and so forth. And as long as you can do that, you're basically away from 95% of any possible trouble.
In August 2001, 3 Irish men were arrested in Bogota in Colombia. The authorities alleged they were members of the Provisional IRA and that they were there training FARC guerrillas. Jim Monaghan was one of the Colombia 3.
All the publicity that you're getting in Colombia was that they were saying that we were IRA who were training the FARC guerrillas. Because of that, that made us kind of, as it were, public enemy number one. That you were nearly worse than the FARC guerrillas because you were actually training them on something which presumably they didn't already know. And we were allowed out each day to make you had 5 minutes for a telephone call. End the thing. So the telephone was in the wall at the foot of the stairs, and the paramilitaries were up the stairs. So the 3 of us would go out one at a time, do your phone call, come back. This day, for some reason, the guard called us out a bit early. The 3 of us made our phone call, went back. We're sitting in the cell. The next thing was this ferocious bang outside, and we didn't know what was happening. There was a bomb at the telephone. And so we found out afterwards that the paramilitaries had got the time that we went to the phone and had thrown the bomb down the stairs, even though they couldn't see.
From the Doc on One programme, Life in La Modelo, which you can hear in full on rt.ie/Doc on One. It's fascinating, and sometimes frankly disappointing, to learn about the musical tastes of popular figures. Yesterday morning, former Taoiseach John Bruton revealed on the John Murray Show that he is a big Bob Dylan fan. And his daughter is one too.
I was sort of amazed when my daughter played some of the songs that she liked. And I said, oh God, I like them too. I expected to hate them. And I think tastes oscillate. And I think, you know, perhaps many young people, she's in her early 20s, would have tastes now that revert back, some of them, to the tastes of sounds that were popular in the 60s.
All right, John, well, thanks for talking to us. We're going to, is that the request that we can play for you?
Please do. I won't be able to hear it from here, but I'd love it. I'd love if you would play it.
Okay, we're going to put it up for you now, actually, John, and we can sing along to it if you want.
Oh, I won't sing, no. Where's the tambourine man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy, and there's no place I'm going to.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer.
Welcome back to Playback. Zbyszek Zielinski here. We're used to technology helping us in our everyday lives, and all is well until it inevitably malfunctions. This is what happened last Sunday at Croke Park during the All-Ireland Minor Hurling Championship semi-final when Limerick played Galway.
So what happened was, and Jackie, you can come in on this as well, when they went to Hawkeye, although the umpire waved that it was a point, and you, Tomás, on TV, yep. Yeah, that's a point, we don't need any Hawkeye or any, that it was a point, it went between the posts. The referee called for Hawkeye. Hawkeye, it came up on the screen, the ball, it showed the ball actually going between the posts.
That's right, and it came up as a miss.
And it came up as a miss. So instead of the referee deciding, well, I've seen it there, the ball going between the posts, it says it's a miss, so it's a miss.
It's a miss, and it's Hawkeye's decision was taken on that basis, so the point wasn't awarded, right? But in the meantime, when we had raised it again at halftime, to say, look, that we all had ticked the box for it being a point, let's have a look at this Hawkeye again, because there is some discrepancy here. We find out afterwards that Hawkeye then has been stopped for the day, has been put down or whatever was going to happen there, right? So somebody needs to explain what happened there, because, so, I mean, I'm not too sure.
Limerick lost the match, and the Limerick minor manager, Jerry Wallace, spoke to Martin Kiley about the effect the Hawkeye affair had on the players.
Traumatic amongst the players, their parents, and anyone else involved with Limerick minor hurling. The players have had to contend with playing an All-Ireland semi-final, having received their leaving cert results, and having to deal with CAO points that place them in colleges. To be honest, Martin, it's traumatic here. We're dealing with a traumatic situation.
And, you know, you saw the players, the disappointment in them. What's your view on Hawkeye now?
My view on Hawkeye would be that that system at this moment in time has let the association down, has let the players down, has let management teams down. It failed.
After a meeting in Thurles, the Central Competitions Control Committee have rejected Limerick's appeal against the outcome of last Sunday's game. Limerick GAA are now going to lodge an appeal with the Central Appeals Committee. The saga continues. But there is one hurling game where Hawkeye is not going to be a problem.
Guinness have set certain criteria, and one of those is that we get at least 250 people, because this is a new record, it hasn't been attempted before. So from that, our aim is well in excess of that. We're hoping that we'll have up to 600 people out, and the committee are working very, very hard to ensure that happens on Sunday.
Do you mean on the pitch at the same time?
Well, not all at the same time, no. It would be very, very easy to put them all and everybody on the pitch at the same time. We can only play a max of 30 people at any time, and everybody must play for at least 10 minutes. There's some of the rules that that Guinness World Records have given us.
And is Hawkeye going to be there?
No, no. We have to keep the scores, but we've got our own video technology in North Cork.
Kieran Lenihan there, one of the organisers. And if you want more information on that attempt at hosting the biggest hurling match ever, you can go to milanvillage.ie. It starts at midday tomorrow, and apparently you don't have to be a hurling pro. I'm not great at hurling myself, and I'm not great with horses either. In fact, I was on a horse only twice in my life, both rather traumatic experiences. But I do smile every time I see a Connemara pony. They're just super, aren't they?
Definitely the Connemara pony has a temperament to die for.
Yeah.
They're a super, super animal. They're very docile, good temperament, they've fantastic staying power, and they're a very, very versatile animal. They've that strengthened and they've fantastic cannon bone and this lovely conformation. They're like getting up in an armchair and away with you.
Like a horse cannot survive out in the west of Ireland. These creatures are genetically modified. They're made for the landscape.
Yeah.
5,000 years they've been wandering there. A horse will have to be taken in winter and sheltered. These creatures can survive out in that
it's
weather.
Extraordinary, extraordinary. Because it's rough country.
I stopped the other week at a gate. My wife glimpsed one.
Yeah.
And where there's one, there's always two. And then suddenly there's three, and then there's four, and then there's five. But they appear up out of the earth. They're like mist. You don't find the ponies, they find you.
So poetic, like mist from the earth. Brian Lally spoke to Tony Curtis on Countrywide, and Tony has a whole book of poetry about ponies. We're moving across the country now, from Connemara to Wicklow, where a famous local resident, actor Daniel Day-Lewis, has been campaigning to build a hospice near Bridges Bay. He spoke to Valerie Cox about personal reasons for backing the campaign.
I'd just seen my mother through her last illness. She had been at a cottage hospital, they call them, in England, which is run by the NHS, National Health Service, very small community hospital. She chose to remain in that hospital, even though it was only a couple of miles from her house. She was still well enough to make that decision and felt so secure, so well taken care of, and so cherished by the people around her that she preferred to stay there. And as awful as that time, one is obviously absorbed to a large extent in with a sense of grief, of anticipated mourning and so on. But nevertheless, I was always mindful of the quality of experience that was allowed us by the extraordinary staff there. There was the professional care, but also the environment itself. And that's why we've decided, with the cooperation and agreement of the HSE, to build the hospice at Mugra Moor.
He also stressed why hospice care is important in any community and in society.
It's also important to say that I think if you're part of any community or any broader society, you know, there are many different ways in which you can measure the quality and the evolution of a society, but not a bad measure is the way in which you take care of the people that are most vulnerable within that community. That would include newborns. We have no place to be born in Wicklow either, so that could be the next thing. But newborns, children, disabled, the sick, the elderly, the dying. If we don't make that a priority and take care of those things, no matter what other great works we achieve within our society, then that is a failing in us, and we can't respect ourselves as a society. And I think the thing that I find most moving, you know, a lot of the people in Wicklow that have given themselves over to this task have not yet had personal experience of hospice care, but they understand in a general way how important it is to make that commitment to the vulnerable people within the society.
Kenneth Egan's greatest sporting achievement was in 2008 when he won the silver medal at the Olympic Games in Beijing. While we were cheering him on, he found it difficult to cope with the success. He spoke to Anya Lawler.
I didn't think it was that big of an achievement until I landed back on Irish soil and seeing when I got off the plane, all the media up in the airport window looking out at it, you know, and for me, I found that amazing and hard to actually understand, you know, and comprehend that. I think there was 4,000 or 5,000 people at the airport. We closed it down for the day because of our achievements. Mm-hmm. And everyone's calling your name and everyone wanted to be, you know, even friends that I knew for years pulling out me looking for a photo where I'd you know, I'd meet them every day on a normal week. So that kind of, I couldn't handle that. And obviously,
and it wasn't just the airport, was it? It was your whole life now, wasn't it?
That was it. My life was turned upside down, you know, media attention and just, but while I got offers to go professional and stuff in America, New York and LA. And while I was trying to make those decisions, they're big decisions and big money involved, I said, right, I'll talk about that again another day. And while I was thinking about making this massive decision to go pro or not, I was drinking and enjoying the high life and enjoying people telling me I was a great bloke and patting me on the back and saying, have another one. I loved all that.
And women flinging themselves at you.
Yeah, that was all there. But I got to the stage where I had no interest in women. I just wanted a drink. I wanted to get as drunk as I possibly could, as fast as I could. And that was the problem. I wasn't a casual drinker. I was there to get drunk.
It was his mother who showed him he needed to do something about his situation.
She brought me up to the graveyard in Talla. She dropped onto her knees.
Graveyard?
The one up across from the square there in Talla. She'd buried 2 sons there years ago. You know, it would have been probably, I'm in their 40s now, you know, in the late 30s. She was on the ground picking the weeds out and fixing them. And the way I was shaking from the drink, having dropped her up, I had a hangover, you know, as usual. But she looked up at me with tears in her eyes and says, Kenneth, if you don't stop drinking, this is where you're going to end up, you know. And I felt brutal that I came to that, though I had my mum on her knees begging me to stop drinking because it was killing me. It was killing me slowly but surely. It's a horrible death, you know. So with that, we got back up and you know, I gave it up then for a while, but I had one more lash at it. I was in Uganda. I was doing a bit of charity work out there. And I was off for 3 months at this time. The longest I've been off in a long time. And I drank on the last night there. There was a bottle of vodka looking at me. And, you know, just say I one drink away from the madness. And that's what happened. I drank again for probably a week and a half. And then I was in Nice on a bender, and my mum came into the pub with me, with my ex-girlfriend at the time. I dropped the point, got into the car, didn't say a word all the way home. We drove home back to the house, and I haven't drank since. I didn't have any spiritual vision or anything like that, or no, nothing like that. It's just the silence was enough. I had enough of it. I tasted defeat there. Alcohol beat me to my knees, and I surrendered, but yet I came out a winner because I haven't touched it since.
Kenneth Egan has been sober for 3 years now. He retired from the ring in February this year, but the battle-ready warrior is still in him.
I do miss the crack you have with the lads and the excitement you get when you're in the dressing room before a fight. That's something you can never get back. I've lost that, you know. It's the feeling of excitement, yeah, / dread. You're thinking there, you're going, why am I doing this? And that's the little feeling I miss in my stomach. You're thinking, I must be mad getting into the ring here about the fight. You know, I'll never get that back.
And talk to me about pain, because, you know, we watch boxing matches. We've all cheered you on and stuff. But at the same time, it's your body. You're the body. It's taken all that, those hits.
Yeah.
That suffering. Used you ever dread that? Or was it something else?
No. That never came into my mind once. Amateur boxing's fairly safe. You wear head guards and the likes, you know, and the rounds are shorter. It's 3 3-minute rounds. You're not doing it like a professional fight where you're in the ring for 12 rounds without a head guard. So it's a different sport altogether. So pain was the least of my worries. But it was just that nervous tension that you had about getting in the ring and fighting, because you're getting ready for battle, more or less. You know, you're going into fight with another man, and the adrenaline is pumping in the dressing room, and you know, you have all these thoughts in your head. Am I going to win? Am I going to lose? How's it going to work out? And that's exciting stuff. And only a fighter will ever have that, you know. Every other sport is different, but I think boxing is the ultimate sport where you're getting ready for a battle with another man. And it's toe-to-toe. There's no one there to help you. It's an individual sport, you know. And as soon as that bell rings, all the stuff you've been learning over the years comes into action. And it's one against one.
Sporting careers can be full of ups and downs. Runner David Gillick faced some tough times recently, but he came out fighting. He's just won the Celebrity MasterChef Ireland on TV.
Over the last 2 years, I've suffered quite badly with injury, and I didn't make the London Olympics through injury, and that really, really affected me. I was down in the dumps and just wasn't myself and wasn't happy at all. And then I got back into training this year, and unfortunately I got injured again. So, you know, it was a tough time, and then I kind of felt, God, what am I going to do with my life? Like, you know, all my eggs were in one basket, and I just felt, you know, that I didn't know what I was going to do next. And then this came along and I jumped at it. Or I ran with it. I just really enjoyed it. Like, I have true injury. I haven't been able to get out on the track and kind of perform and get that buzz, you know, in front of people and get a good reaction when you run well and all that. And I missed that. I really did. I missed it. But the big thing I learned from MasterChef was, before you come in to that kitchen, you go through the doors, and I got that buzz. People might think that because you've got medals and stuff like that, you're always riding high with confidence. And I think you'd be surprised of how many elite sports people out there actually kind of would suffer, maybe with a little bit of depression and also, you know, a bit of insecurities as well. And like, we're all human, you know, and it's amazing that no matter what you do in life, we all kind of think the same. And that was really it. And it was great to just get that buzz back, and obviously to go on then and win it. Like, it was amazing. Even today, like, I went out for a run this morning and I was running around with a smile on my face. You know, it's great. It's just really bigs you up. Like,
running 400 metres in less than 45 seconds and impressing Dylan McGrath. Fair play. MasterChef and runner David Gillick spoke to Brenda Donoghue on Monday's Mooney Show. It looks like David is not the only well-known Irishman who's a dab hand in the kitchen. Shane Lynch from Boyzone is competing at the moment in the UK version of Celebrity MasterChef. Some of his ingredients are a bit pricey, though.
Wagyu beef, or Kobe beef is another name for it, is it's a cow that's reared basically on beer and fed beer. So the fat that runs through the meat is a lot more, but it's kind of marbleized throughout the beef. And it's kind of hand massaged as well, believe it or not, the actual cows themselves. So I think each steak that I cooked last night was about £100 each, or €100 each to buy. So it's the most expensive beef in the world, basically.
I was getting worried watching it, because it did look like an absolutely stunning piece of beef, even though I'm not sure I'd pay £100 for it. But I was getting worried actually at one stage, and I think Greg and John were as well, that you maybe were overcooking the beef a tiny bit, but you seem to have got that right.
No, it's all. It was more about just getting it nice and caramelised, like crispy on the outside, just so it gets that flavour. Because the actual, if you overcook it, the marble within the fat within the beef itself, you can destroy that down into the core. So that's, it's about kind of getting it on a really, really hot pan, getting the outside seared really fast for the inside to kind of melt into the beef, and it's, that's what makes it the stunning flavour.
He definitely got the chefy lingo, if not the price right. €100 for a steak? Well, the cows are hand-massaged. Shane's love of food goes all the way back to his childhood, but you'd be mistaken if you thought it was ordinary meat and two veg. Even at Christmas, his family went for something quite exotic.
When it comes to Christmas dinner, we actually don't have a turkey as a family. Since I'm a baby, all I remember is that we have lobsters. And that's kind of...
Lobster for Christmas dinner?
We have lobster for Christmas dinner. We don't do a turkey or ham and all that kind of stuff. So I'm a massive kind of shellfish lover because of that.
Anya Lawler sounded a bit surprised with that Christmas lobster, didn't she? Well, if you're looking for a more affordable recipe from the Boys on Hung, get a pen and paper. Here it comes.
The dish I cooked is called a cataplana. And it's just basically a bit of white wine, onions, garlic, tomato, kind of all cooked down, and then you throw your fish in at the last minute just to flavour it and cook it up, whatever that fish may be, from an actual monkfish to any kind of shellfish you want to put in there, from clams, prawns, mussels, whatever you decide to throw in. So it's one of my favourite childhood dishes, and that's why I did it.
I'm not sure if the members of another boy band, One Direction, cook at all. Perhaps everything is revealed in their latest movie. It premiered earlier on this week to the delight of thousands of screaming fans across the globe.
Well, we can go live to Leicester Square now and talk to Richard Arnold, who is showbiz editor with ITV's Daybreak programme. Richard, thanks a million for joining us this evening. What's the scene there like at the moment?
Well, in a word, bedlam. I've actually taken cover from the hordes of fans. You mentioned thousands. I can only hazard a guess as to how many girls and boys are out there, and dads and mums too, who are cheering on these lads. I've never known a premiere like it, and I've covered many over the last sort of 15 years or so. I couldn't even hear the responses to the boys' questions when they were talking to me. The screams were off the scale. I think even Simon Cowell may have had a tear in his eye.
Simon Cowell might have become emotional, but no tears for our own Gavin Jennings. No, no, he was not convinced.
To the untrained 30-something male ear, they don't sound any different to any other boy band we've heard over the last 30 years. What's different about One Direction?
You're talking to another untrained 30-year-old musical ear. I think what's different about One Direction is a couple of things. Firstly, there are other factors in play here other than the music.
Hormones?
Well, Gavin, I think you should listen to Lara, a directioner. That's what the fans are called. She spoke to Ryan Tubridy on 2FM.
For one, they're absolutely gorgeous.
Right.
I love their music. They seem like really nice guys as well.
Now, apart from the fact that they're good-looking, what else do they do for you?
Well, they seem to love music as well, and they can all sing, and they just look like they have a really good job as well. Like, I'd really love to go into the music industry myself.
So let me recap. They're gorgeous, and they love music. And that, Gavin, appears to be enough. One way or another, I'm gonna find ya. I'm gonna get you, get you, get you, get you. One way or another, I'm gonna win ya. I'll get you, I'll get you. One way or another, I'm gonna see ya. I'm gonna meet ya, meet ya, meet ya, meet ya. One day, maybe next week, I'm gonna meet ya. I'll meet ya, meet ya, meet ya. And if the lights are Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer. Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Welcome back to Playback. Zbyszek Zielinski here. There were harrowing reports from Syria this week. Hundreds of people were killed in an alleged chemical weapons attack on a Damascus suburb controlled by the rebels. Drive Time's Brian Lally spoke to Irish Syrians.
My wife is in Syria right now. You watch the news and you see somebody you don't know dying. But when you hear it personally, like my wife, for example, told me that her friend died. She told, I've heard her crying on the phone. You can't put it into words, you know. You often ask yourself, what can you do? The blood of the Syrian people has become cheaper than water.
This is like a new Holocaust for us. It's a new Holocaust. It's like the children dying like this way. To the doctors there in field hospital have nothing to can do. We just need from European Union, from the whole the world, from United Nations, to stand and support the civilian in Syria.
Michael Ryan is the charge d'affaires for the European Union delegation in Syria.
Why is the EU, or why are more particularly individual countries within the EU, so unwilling to intervene here, where there was more willingness, as we saw most recently with Libya and with other conflicts in the past? What's changed here?
I think this is a very complicated conflict. It has become complicated over the last year. The presence of foreign Islamic jihadi fighters, some of them from Europe, has added a complicated dimension. The role of Russia as strong ally of Syria remains a factor in determining how the international community can respond, at least at the UN level. I don't think there is any strong appetite to commit European forces at this stage. We have the nearest thing will be UN observers in South Lebanon, and now Irish troops will be deployed to the Golan. I don't think it's going to go any further than that.
But whatever about appetite, if it is verified that a chemical attack took place from whatever side, will that appetite be overridden by a compulsion to go in?
It's not for me to predict what might be the response from the international community or the European Union. But if the finger of blame is pointed quite convincingly at one party or the other, I think that might alter the dynamics of how we perceive the conflict.
Michael Ryan there talking to Gavin Jennings on Morning Ireland yesterday. While we hear about the emerging property bubble in Dublin, latest figures show that the number of mortgages in arrears continues to rise. Filomena took out a bridging loan in 2007, but the sale of her house fell through and she now owes the bank €175,000. She tried to negotiate with the bank, but to no avail.
They're not dealing with it. They're not getting it that there are human beings out here. You know, that personal lives, that our lives are, moving in these homes that we've... I mean, I had to sell my home with all the furniture and everything. I've nothing. I don't know where I'm going to start again. I just don't know where. And I just need a little help. I just need something. I even wrote to Minister Michael Noonan, but you may as well forget that because they don't reply. Do you know? I mean, I don't know who to turn to.
You're asking them to write off 45,000, isn't it?
Yeah, okay. Or at worst, even write off, say come to an agreement about half of it. Okay. Let me pay back half of that 45.
Which would be a relatively small percentage, given what you paid back in total with interest.
Absolutely, Joe. I don't think it's a very
and
big...
And how long more can you stay in your son's
well,
house?
How long can I stand sleeping on the mattress on the floor? I don't know. God. I'm 53. Where am I going? I have a grandchild due any day now. This is all upsetting for the household, for them, me sleeping in their home and all the rest of it.
Filomena spoke to Joe Duffy on Liveline. Finance journalist Jill Kirby analysed the mortgage figures from the central bank on the Today programme.
The only genuine solution is twofold. One is some serious writing down of debt and writing down of mortgages much closer to real market values, which we're going to be with for decades. The other side of it, there is a magnificent recovery and both employment numbers go up and people's incomes start going up and taxes start falling again. I mean, that's a way to
and
sort
pigs
out
might fly.
Problem. Well, exactly. I mean, I'm sure it's going to happen someday, but it's not going to happen in this quarter or the next quarter.
There's been a lot of talk about strategic defaulters coming, obviously, from the banks. Is there also an argument that there is strategic inaction amongst the banks for very obvious reasons?
Well, I don't know if the reasons are that obvious. I'm trying to speak to people in the
bank. Well, they don't want to write down. They don't want
to
write down that they don't want to.
Well, it's not. At this stage, I'm not even sure if it's that they don't want to. I'm not sure they're allowed to. We're talking about the Irish banks, which are mainly Irish-owned. Our government has the IMF looking over and the Troika looking over their shoulder. The writing off of massive amounts of mortgage debt in this country would probably result in our banks needing another bailout. And that has all sorts of implications for everything from, the country's capacity to get out of our program and start borrowing on the markets to the cost to depositors. It's been made quite clear by the finance ministers of the EU in the last few months, especially during our own presidency, that if countries come back to them looking for bailouts for their banks, well, you know, depositors are going to have to take a hit.
The Spinning Heart is a book that deals with the aftermath of the property crash in Ireland. It's the debut novel by Donal Ryan. He spoke to Evie Ní Houlihan last Sunday morning and read from the book.
I was always jealous of Shawnee Shaper growing up. Any time I ever called to Shawnees, I'd hear them laughing when I got to the bend before their house. They'd all be roaring laughing at some aping the father would be at, and the mother would be cooking and telling them to shut up their fooling, but she'd be laughing herself. The odd time I'd stay and eat, and Shawnee and his brothers and sisters would take ages to finish because he'd be laughing so much. Their father was wiry and kind-looking. He had a lovely smile. He'd warm you with it. You knew there was nothing in him, only good nature. He had a big pile of old Ireland's Own magazines he'd look for when he had a dinner at. He needed them for the song words. They'd all roll their eyes, they'd have to be disgusted, but still and all they'd clap and sing along while he pounded out the songs, The Rattling Bog and The Rising of the Moon and Camochi Black and Tens. It twisted my soul, the pleasure of that house, the warmth of it and the laughter. It was nearly unbearable to be there and to have half my mind filled with the chill and the gloom and the thick silence of our cottage. I hate a Shawnee Shaper for having a father like that and not even knowing his look.
And that fun-loving dad of Shawnee Shaper is actually based on Donald's father. Another book that hit our airwaves this week was The Art of Sleeping Alone by Sophie Fontanelle. She is the editor of Elle magazine in France, and in her book she reveals that she gave up sex for 12 years. She told Catherine Thomas that at the beginning her friends could not understand it.
After the first year, someone asked me, Sophie, do you make love? And do you have boyfriends? And for the first time, I told the truth. I said no. And my friends say, it's too much. Mm. Too much. You're going to die. You're going to forget how to make love. Immediately, they wanted to find a man for me. And I was invited at a lot of dinners where everybody was in couple. But at the corner of the table next to me, there was a single man. And he was looking at me in a very angry way because he was looking at me as a possible target. And he was judging me. So it was not a charm between us. Mm-hmm. And after the dinner, everybody was saying, Sophie, you have your car. Maybe you can go away with Andrew or Robert. And I refused. My refuse was a scandal.
A very French scandal. And that's it from me for this week. The Whileaways are three fine singers from Galway. Their debut album is out now, and you can find out more on thewhileawaysmusic.com. They played live for Miles Dungan on the Today programme earlier on this week. The song is Dear My Maker. Until next time, have a great weekend. Goodbye.
Dear my maker, you made me a heartbreaker, and I'd like to write you a letter of complaint. Dear my maker, oh, you made me not a taker of this fine man that brightened my days. Oh, the river flows from east to west into the swell of the bay, with so many there when I walked alone to show me the way. But I raised up my hand, turned my face to the lamp. I'm here to break hearts and turn love away. Dear my maker, lover's tunes keep playing, dancing couples keep smiling and swaying, but I get on my own, small steps the world I roam. Farewell, goodbye is all I have known. Oh, the river flows. flows from east to west into the swell of the bay. With so many there when I walked alone to show me the way. But I raised up my hand, turned my face to the land. I'm here to break hearts and turn love away. Dear my maker, I'm a little old-fashioned.